House, please come to order. In accord with the uniform rules, I'll now turn the meeting over to the President of the Senate, Senator Curtula.
Joint session will please come to order. Senator Ray.
Mr. President, I would move that the roll call for the Senate be waived and all members be shown present.
So ordered. Majority Leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move and ask unanimous consent that the roll call of the House be waived and all members be shown as present.
So ordered.
Mr. Speaker, will I have the floor?
You have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Would you help me welcome the wife of our junior senator from Alaska, Ms. Nancy Murkowski, CPLEA.
There are some guests for introductions. Senator Victor Fisher.
Mr. President, on this Valentine's Day, I very much appreciate the opportunity to introduce two very good friends. My very best and closest friend in the gallery behind me, my wife, Jane Renvick. And next to her, the Associate Dean of Harvard University and Kennedy School of Government, and very appropriately named for this day, William Trueheart.
The floor, Mr. Rules Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In Gallery B, I have a young lady who is a constituent of mine from Sheldon Point, Ms. Rose Prince.
Representative Barnes.
Thank you, Mr. President. Also in Gallery A is a new employee of our Senator Murkowski, Mr. Bert Hall. Help me welcome him, please.
This time it's my privilege to appoint a delegation to wait upon the Senator and bring him to these chambers, Senator Kelly, Senator Mike Miller. We will stand at ease while they bring the Senator to the chambers. The one from Fairbanks.
Do I say madam?
Absolutely.
We're beginning to have statewide influence here.
Privilege today to introduce a man who was a freshman in the U.S. Senate and has made considerable achievement. His latest committee appointments in the areas of mineral and energy development and Pacific Rim trade will be of direct benefit for Alaska, and I'm sure he's going to speak to us on those topics today. He's earned the respect of his colleagues both in Washington and in Alaska, and I know we are well served by his efforts in the nation's capital. It is my honor at this time to introduce to you Senator Frank Murkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, for that very welcome introduction. And President Curtula, Speaker Hayes, and members of the 13th Alaska Legislature. It's good to be home among friends and fellow Alaskans, and I might add that I'm glad to see you're still holding Fort Rae here in Juneau. I'm grateful for the opportunity to address you in this joint session and share with you the highlights of many of the federal issues that currently affect our state. First, let me congratulate all of you on your election to our legislature, as well as wish you all a very happy Valentine's Day. I just came from the governor's office, and I forgot to remind him that he can still run out and get a Valentine for those dates that he had during the inauguration. So, Governor, you got the word. There will be tremendous challenges facing Alaska in the coming months, and I look forward to working with you, new Governor Sheffield, and his cabinet in meeting those challenges. I believe this year, the 25th anniversary of congressional approval of Alaska statehood, is an especially appropriate time to reflect on our accomplishments and to look to new opportunities for growth and improvement. As you are already well aware, those of us in Washington have been faced in the last few years with an ever-growing misconception of our state by outsiders. A recent incident is one hopefully extreme example of that difficulty. Late last year, Congress passed my amendment exempting Alaska youths who had no other income other than their permanent fund dividend from filing income tax forms. The next morning, my press secretary received a call from a major television network reporter. The reporter was enraged. "What's this about tax exemption for Alaska miners?" she asked. "Coal miners in other states have to pay income taxes. Why should Alaskans be treated any differently?" Well, such ignorance is perhaps at times laughable, but it shows that we're being watched. The Alaska congressional delegation in Washington is eager to work with you on those issues which will be key to the future of our state. These issues include hydropower, natural gas marketing, export of Alaska's resources to our Pacific Rim neighbors, visitor facilities, the Alaska Railroad, and the establishment of an Arctic Research Center in Alaska, as well as many, many more. It is for these reasons I have revised my committee assignments and am now in a better position to add to the balance of our congressional delegation, to hold the ground we have gained since statehood and expand into the future. It is certainly no secret to you that our national resource revenues are the envy of virtually every other state in our nation. And that is the reason I sought the chairmanship of the Energy and Natural Resource Subcommittee on Energy Regulation. This subcommittee has the jurisdiction over a wide variety of issues, including the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC as it's known. This organization oversees pipeline rates, hydro licensing, natural gas pricing, and certain electric utility issues. We are all aware of the tremendous implications of the TAPS tariff rate case currently before FERC. Last year in the Energy Committee, I successfully headed off a proposal which would have deregulated TAPS, resulting in substantial increases in the TAPS tariff at the expense of our state. For each dollar of increases in the TAPS tariff, the state would lose roughly $150 million annually in revenues. In a related issue, there may be a need to amend the windfall profits tax to continue an exemption for oil produced above Alaska's Arctic Circle. In October, a Wyoming district court judge found the present exemption to be unconstitutional and ruled the entire windfall profits tax illegal. His decision has been appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and while we expect the district court to be reversed, it is a possibility that the Alaska exemption may not survive. The loss of the Arctic exemption could substantially curtail future Alaska oil exploration and production. With the loss of the exemption, the windfall profits tax on that oil could rise from a current rate of zero to 25%. Some estimates are that the state could lose more than $1 billion in severance tax revenues and state royalty oil between now and 1991. Another threat that Alaska faces is the possibility that Congress could restrict our severance taxes on oil. Just a few days ago, Senator Dixon from Illinois reintroduced a bill which would limit state severance taxes to 1978 levels and require that revenues generated from those taxes be used only for programs relating to energy development. This legislation is based on the argument that since the taxes paid on our oil are used to fund the general treasury, people from the lower 48 are paying for Alaska's programs that have no relation to energy development. The proponents of this argument, who are largely from the financially troubled Northeast, think Alaskans are freeloading on the price their energy consumers pay, and that we have set ourselves up as an elite class of United States citizens. If Senator Dixon's bill should pass, Alaska would no longer be able to put oil tax money into the general treasury for use on state projects. This could put a large enough drain on the state treasury to require possibly the reinstatement of the state income tax. I don't mean to be an alarmist. Obviously, we will be joined by senators from other energy-producing states to fight this type of legislation. However, you must be aware that there is a very, very real threat. In addition to serving as chairman of the Energy Regulatory Subcommittee, I will continue to serve on the Senate Water and Power Subcommittee. I join with most Alaskans in the conviction that hydropower is a crucial component to the state's energy future. It is renewable, it's clean, dependable, and in the long term, inexpensive. Its development will allow us to move more of Alaska's non-renewable energy resources, our oil, our gas, and coal, to world markets and use these revenues to pay for the hydro projects and other renewable resources. Over the past few years, we have seen progress on hydro development in our state. We've also seen growing controversy surrounding the state's biggest hydro proposal, Susitna. Some are concerned about the cost of the project. Others question if Alaska will truly need the amount of power it would generate. I understand that a soon-to-be-released poll shows a vast majority of Alaskans favor development of Susitna. My hope is that Alaskans won't get caught up in the short-term disadvantages of the system and lose sight of what is in the long range and best interests of our state. I'd like to share with you an observation I made while at home in Fairbanks last month. During the several days I was there, the temperature stood at a steady 49 degrees below zero. The ice fog was extremely bad, and as the community grows, it may get worse. Well, there's no question that automobiles contribute significantly to this problem. Let's not overlook the amount of pollution from other sources. What if Fairbanks were to be an all-electric city whose energy source was hydro? I would urge those who are critical of the Susitna project to consider how this source of energy could solve what's becoming a serious clean air problem in Fairbanks and other Alaska communities. Why, even Juneau had an alert from wood smoke out in the valley this winter. So air pollution is a growing concern. I recently witnessed another example of the need to consider long-term benefits of development alongside well-intentioned environmental concerns. In January, Nancy and I attended the opening ceremony of the new 80-mile pipeline constructed across Panama to carry Alaska oil to the Gulf Coast refineries. This project was completed after the proposed PACTEX pipeline between Long Beach, California and Texas was abandoned. That project was rejected because environmentalists in Southern California opposed an increase in tanker traffic which would have occurred in Long Beach Harbor as ships begin unloading oil at that port. But let's take a look at some of the long-term ramifications of that decision to build a new pipeline across Panama instead of sending the oil through a U.S. pipeline system, much of which was already in place. First, the pipeline now lies in a foreign nation, and Alaska Oil, presently 800,000 barrels per day, destined for domestic use, was going through that pipeline then. That oil must travel through an area outside our jurisdiction and outside our nation's borders. Second, the Panamanian government received a 40% equity interest in the pipeline simply by letting it cross Panamanian land. So that nation, and neither the U.S. consumer nor the state of Alaska, will realize up to the $120 million a year revenues that the Panamanian government receives from the pipeline project. To put that into some perspective, the Panamanian government receives $80 million annually from the Panama Canal. Third, the distance the oil must be moved by tanker has been increased by 4,400 miles. This means more tankers and more transportation costs, which of course are ultimately being passed on to the United States consumer. But the ships traveling from Valdez to Panama now must go into the port of Long Beach to take on bunker fuel. There is no facility in either Valdez or Panama for fueling these tankers. So the ironic conclusion to this example is that today there are just as many tankers fueling in Long Beach as there would have been had the oil been delivered there in the first place. The beginning of the 98th Congress presents me with a challenge of promotion for the tremendous opportunities associated for Alaska's long-term economic growth. I think this is especially so in light of my new position as chairman of the Subcommittee on Pacific and East Asian Affairs. The state's abundant natural resources have been the subject of great interest from Japan, Korea, Taiwan, and China. And I enjoy the position of being the first Alaskan senator on that Foreign Relations Committee, and I'm looking forward to making every effort to focus more attention upon the trading potential of the Pacific region. We've all perhaps heard too much rhetoric about commercial exchanges between Alaska and the Far East. The opportunity to market our gas, our coal, our pulp, timber, fish, and other Alaska products is now at hand. One issue which has been in the news lately is a proposal to allow the export of Alaska North Slope oil to Japan. I find the proposal initially intriguing, but I have not seen enough facts to totally convince me at this time of its merits. The swap proposal is currently generating more attention because of increasing surpluses of oil on the West Coast and the availability of Mexican oil to our major Gulf Coast refiners. Under the proposal, we would purchase Mexican oil and Japan would purchase a small amount of Alaska oil. We're all familiar with the biggest plus for the arrangement. The savings in transportation costs would increase the wellhead value of Alaskan oil and generate significantly higher revenues for our state. It would also be advantageous for Alaska because it could give the state an alternative market for its crude oil. Under current production of state royalty oil, there are nearly 100,000 barrels per day, which might be available for foreign export. Of course, on the downside of this proposal is the effect it could have on the maritime industry. Substantial investments have been made in building U.S. tanker fleets to transport Alaskan oil. If we were to permit Alaska crude to be transported to Japan by foreign vessels, we would be allowing those domestic tankers and their crews to lay idle. American jobs are certainly at stake. However, I personally believe that the oil is valuable enough to Japan to negotiate an agreement under which U.S. tankers could continue to be used. And as an aside, I might clarify that the value of the oil to Japan is not so much its quantity, but in the signal it sends to Japan's OPEC suppliers that Japan has an alternate source of energy. In fact, the oil to Japan may be such that it would be willing to relax some of its trade restrictions on American beef, citrus fruits, other agricultural products, perhaps even automobiles. Such action would have the added advantage of generating congressional support for the swap. The swap proposal is going to be addressed in the coming months by the United States-Japan Energy Study Group, which was formed as a result of recent meetings between President Reagan and Japanese Prime Minister Nakasone. I've personally had an opportunity to talk with Secretary of State Schultz about the study group, and he has assured me that in my capacity as chairman of the East Asian and Pacific Affairs Subcommittee, I will have access to the study group's deliberations. That is important not only because of the oil export proposal, but because the group will be considering two other topics of great interest to Alaska's future, and they are Japanese and Pacific Rim countries' financing of the development of U.S. and Alaska energy export infrastructure. This is primarily directed at Alaska coal and the marketing of Alaska natural gas in the Orient. When I addressed this legislature last year, I had just received word that the financing for the Alaska natural gas transportation system had encountered roadblocks because of falling world oil prices and other reasons. 1 year later, that financing is still in question. Consequently, we have not seen construction of the Alaska leg of the pipeline, but the pre-built sections from Canada to the Midwest and Western United States have been completed and are today transporting more than 1,215,000,000 cubic feet of Canadian gas per day to those lower 48 markets. That could lead one to the conclusion that Canadian gas may be filling the markets originally designated for Alaska gas for some time. In the meantime, former Governors Hicklin-Egan and other members of the Governor's Study Group have released their report on marketing Alaska's natural gas. I am pleased that the report is receiving critical examination by various interested parties, including the U.S.-Japan Study Group. If the producers who own the gas think that the project provides them with a return that's sufficiently attractive, and if the customers overseas find the price competitive and the market is there, then the project indeed has merit. I think it is important to point out, however, that while technically only an export permit is needed for an all-Alaska gas project, it is naive to think that the Congress would not want to have a voice in this decision. Any long-term contract to export Alaska's energy resources will surely require the blessings of Congress, an action in which I would be actively involved in my subcommittee chairmanship. Another issue that I'm pleased to be involved with is the Alaska export of coal to Korea. In late December, the Korea Electric Power Company agreed to a contract with the Sunil Alaska Company to begin in 1984 shipments of coal to an electric power generating plant in Korea. Last year, I was in Korea and met with their president, the Minister of Resources, and the president of the Korea Electric Power Company to discuss this and other Alaska projects. I continue to remain in close contact with these individuals and have one staff member in my office explicitly responsible for Alaska Asian trade. In the near future, I will be holding hearings on East Asian and U.S. trade in order to fully explore the scope of markets and character of the demand for Alaska and lower 48 goods. I also intend to hold hearings on the advisability of promoting a Pacific Basin community. The results of such a proceedings may help us to decide whether or not Alaska should take the lead in helping establish an Asian common market modeled after the European common market. Throughout these deliberations, I intend to work closely with Governor Sheffield's administration and with its export-minded Commissioner of Commerce, Dick Lyon. While economic relations with our East Asian neighbors have very definite benefits, they're certainly not trouble-free. One problem that we've been working on is an increasingly important issue in Alaska's fisheries, joint ventures with foreign nations. Although the amount of fish caught in Alaska waters processed under joint ventures leaped from 3.3 million pounds in 1979 to 210 million pounds in 1981. Only three Alaska fishing vessels were involved in the 34 joint ventures last year. The other vessels, for the most part, were from the state of Washington. This inequity is unacceptable to me. I have spent a great deal of time recently talking to representatives of Korea and Japan, the two countries most involved in the joint ventures, to try and persuade them to work with Alaska fishermen. I support the concept of joint ventures, but believe we should watch them carefully so our participants don't end up being sharecroppers for foreign processors. Another of my priorities in this session of Congress is the Arctic Research Bill. Although this bill passed the Senate last year, it was stalled in the House Science and Technology Subcommittee. I have been working closely with Don Young and Representative Fuqua, who heads that committee. In fact, I was right the first time. I'm counting on Don Young to take Representative Fuqua on a trip up to Alaska this year. The congressman has been to Antarctica twice, so his perceptions of Alaska are generated from those observations. I believe that the Arctic Research Bill will go a long way towards helping us develop Alaska's resources from the Arctic in a responsible and thoughtful manner. It has been estimated that nearly $1 billion could have been saved on the TAPS pipeline if the United States would have had the research capability which would be established by this legislation. And let's not forget the National Petroleum Council has predicted that 44 billion barrels of recoverable oil and oil equivalent gas still exist to be found in Alaska's Arctic. Another issue I've been actively pursuing along with Ted and Don is our proposed hunting amendment to the Alaska Lands Act. There are currently 32 million acres of federal parkland in Alaska, 25 million of which were open to hunting prior to 1980, but are now closed. Under our legislation, approximately 12 million acres would be redesignated from park to park preserve status. Trapping and sports hunting only would continue to be barred on the remaining 20 million acres, or 63% of federal parkland. Under the amendment, the state would manage these lands since the federal government now has only one fish and game biologist stationed in Alaska, and I understand the state of Alaska has 93. It's evident which group agency could properly manage the resource. I recently questioned the Secretary of the Department of Interior, Jim Watt, on that point, and Secretary Watt agreed that the state has a much better management capability. And I think it's probably appropriate to say thanks to Secretary Watt for his recent services to Alaska. As you know, he's been frequently criticized nationally, but the figures on Alaska lands speak for themselves. In the 25 years since statehood, Alaska has received 60 million acres of the 104 million acres promised us by the federal government. 21 million acres, or one-third of that total, have come to Alaska in the last 2 years under Secretary Watt's stewardship. He has also helped the state achieve its goal of transferring federal lands to Alaska's native regional corporations. In the past 2 years, these corporations have received 8 million acres of land compared to the 10 million acres they'd received in the 10 year prior to Watt's administration. And I think it's also appropriate to recognize that Alaska alone, among the 50 states, has provided for the descendants of its native peoples. Our attention to our Aboriginal people will prove to be one of Alaska's very greatest investments. Although I'm personally disappointed that Mount Edgecombe High School will be closing this year, my efforts and others to keep it open for an additional year gave both students and staff some needed transition time. I hope that the state will somehow be able to fulfill the needs of Native students who will be without a boarding high school. In closing, I would like to mention briefly the national scene. In spite of our past problems, I agree with President Reagan when he says that America is on the mend. Our economy is currently recovering from the recession, and the signs are clear. The prime rate is down from a high of 21.5% in December of 1980 to 11% presently. The rate has come down in part because we have finally brought inflation under control. In 1980, the inflation rate was 12.4%. Now the rate is under 4%, and signs are good for the first 6 months of this year. But the attention of Congress must now be focused on unemployment and the deficit. But I contend unemployment is being reduced. Workers are being called back to their jobs. Now, our current fiscal year budget will be about $805 billion. Yet in that, we have a projected deficit of nearly $200 billion. Consider for a moment that we have already accumulated in this nation a deficit of $1 trillion, with interest on that deficit running $140 billion annually. This interest does not create one job in this nation. One only has to go back a few weeks ago, where we passed a 5-cent a gallon gas tax passed by Congress to recognize the extreme ends we are now going to maintain our interstate highway system, provide for accelerated job programs, and so forth. Recognize further that it took this nation 207 years to accumulate its first $1 trillion deficit. With the projected deficits this year of nearly $200 billion, one can recognize that unless we dramatically change direction, we will have accumulated the second $1 trillion deficit in just about 5.5 years. The realities are obvious. We have no other choice but to dramatically reduce the rate of federal growth of our government. This is not an easy subject as we deliberate the methods and the direction. I personally could perhaps support some type of a value-added tax if it were to be directed specifically to reducing the accumulated deficit. And I could perhaps support the president's standby tax program of 1% of the GNP on a temporary basis. But I do not believe that this country can regain economic prosperity by simply increasing taxes from the private sector and sending those tax revenues undirected back to Washington. Although I agree with many proposals included in the president's budget, I firmly believe changes must be made in defense spending. The Joint Chiefs of Staff should be given a percentage cut, as other federal departments have been given, and should set their own cutting priorities at that point. Other changes will be necessary, and the final product may not be totally satisfactory to everyone. However, if we are to overcome the threat of our huge budget deficit and the threat it proposes on our monetary system and really to our American lifestyle, we must take the same bipartisan approach adopted so successfully by the President's Social Security Commission. When we have control of the deficits, we will have solved the major problem of unemployment. I welcome your comments on all federal issues of interest to the state. I hope that you and our new governor will continue to call upon Senator Stevens, Representative Young, and myself to help you in your efforts, and we will continue to rely on you for advice, guidance, and direction. Thank you for extending me this opportunity to address you today. And with your permission, I would be happy to answer any questions if it's appropriate. Thank you.
I would like to have people that haven't had a chance during the previous joint session to be key lead off on questions. Senator Fahrenkamp, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. President. Kowski, what effect do you see
stabilizing having on the possibility of trading in the country if we are perceived to be in a leadership role or out front in the efforts to secure that?
Well, I think Alaska is a bit unique in its structure. We are separated, as no other state is, by a foreign country. For all practical purposes, we are the United States' only Asian state. Traditionally, our resource markets, with the exception of oil, have been marketed in the Pacific Rim. So I think that acceptability, because of our geographical location, is already established. And I think with that goes a recognized perception that that's where Alaska's resources will be marketed, simply because we're non-competitive, for the most part, with the exception, again, of oil, for the West Coast markets, which have resources and energy and so forth and so on, closer to population centers. So I think the pattern has been established steady.
You have the floor.
Yes, thank you, Mr. President. Senator Murkowski, the question is, in regard to, you talked about the importance of economic growth in Alaska and how we have to excel in that area. What's your position on streamlining at federal level something where we could improve the leasing as far as oil and gas development in the Outer Continental Shelf? And what's your perception about the permitting on that?
Well, that's a subject that's, of course, received a great deal of notoriety of late, and it's a complex situation. My attitude, first of all, is that we've made great advancements in technology with regard to offshore development and the potentials associated with it. I think the industry is not going to jeopardize the confidence that it has built up in Alaska by doing anything that it doesn't think it can do. I think the industry's done an outstanding job in Cook Inlet, as displayed by the oil platforms that have withstood a couple of decades nearly of ice activity. As far as the ability to respond and relate to the people that are affected by the impact associated with OCS development, I think that the industry and the state is attempting to respond to those concerns, and as to specifically where they are in that, it's difficult to tell because everybody has an individual interpretation. But oil is where you find it, and we all recall not so many years ago when we were concerned about the impact that was going to occur in Seward and the impact that was going to occur in Yakutat and the tremendous activity associated with the Gulf of Alaska sale. The only thing is they didn't find any oil. What we're talking about in reality in most of these offshore sales areas is a time frame of 5 to 7 years before there is any development, assuming there are commercial quantities of oil. And the quantities have to be substantial, otherwise you're not going to develop that oil. So I think we need a greater communication between all the interested parties so we can be more responsive to the people who have some very genuine concerns about what this impact will bring.
Representative Fisher. Senator Fisher.
Mr. President, Senator Murkowski, last week Senator Ted Stevens gave a ringing endorsement for the Equal Rights Amendment and look forward to action by the Congress. I was wondering how you see the outlook and what's your personal view on the amendment.
I have been a co-sponsor of that amendment in the last session, and I'm also a co-sponsor in the new session. I think that it will proceed through the process as did the last time, and I have as guesses as good as yours as to ultimately what will happen, but it's been the perception of the constituents for the most part that have reached me that they want to have the opportunity to have that on the ballot and proceed through the customary constitutional procedure, and I'm in total support of that concept. But where it ultimately goes is going to be decided by a vote of the people, and that's as provided under the Constitution.
Representative Bettisworth has been seeking the floor. I'll try to bounce back and forth between two sides. You have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator, in reference to this working group that you spoke of between the United States and Japan having to do with resources, since there's going to be a strong emphasis on the exportation of Alaska's oil, coal, and other resources, might be prudent for the legislature to have either a working member or observer on that group. So would you care to advise us on that?
Well, I might advise you that that group is really being coordinated by the head of the National Security Council, Judge Bill Clark. I've met, as I indicated, on one occasion with him, and they have kept us advised of the formation of the group. Now, as to the appropriateness of the legislature, I would certainly be happy to try and provide a liaison if you felt it appropriate or whatever other means. I think it is important that they have the collective input of the legislature and the administration because they're talking about Alaska resources. Let's not kid ourselves. And their interest is motivated by the fact that that's federal land, and they obviously do have a voice. But the terms and conditions under which we allow our resources to be developed, I think, is a policy matter that should be established by Alaskans in the legislative body. We have made some direct inquiries as to whether or not we can participate in their meetings. we have been advised that they will keep us informed. So that's the response that the congressional delegation has received, or I have personally received.
Senator Petty, John Newman speaking to the floor.
Mr. President, Senator Murkowski, with the completion, as you mentioned in your draft, the Trans-Panamanian pipeline, is there any chance that the state will receive an additional price on Wellhead oil?
Well, that's something that I kind of went down to Panama to make some inquiries about, because I assumed, as we all do, that the wellhead price and the transportation costs have a direct relationship. If you reduce the transportation cost, the wellhead ought to go up and Alaska ought to generate more revenues. Until I begin to look into that little arrangement, and that particular pipeline is an 80-mile pipeline. It was built at a cost of about $380 million based on a throughput of about 200,000 to 300,000 barrels a day. It presently is flowing at 800,000 barrels a day. The owner is a private corporation called Northville Industries, which operates a pipeline the length of Long Island, New York. And they got into that business many, many decades ago when they went out of the coal business. But the point is that they had a three-year throughput from Arcos, Ohio, and Exxon, which they took to the bank, obtained the financing on, and I assume figured that there would be 300,000 to 400,000 barrels a day. The fact that there's 800,000 barrels a day, I think, is most significant to the state of Alaska. I am told that that savings is going to go strictly to increase the amortization schedule rather than have any reduction on transportation charges. But there was one other senator from New York who was there, myself. I would strongly suggest, with your permission, that the legislature kind of follow where your oil goes.
Give the floor, sir. And Representative Pesson.
Senator Murkowski, I'd like to take this opportunity, if I may, to thank you very much on behalf of constituents of my district and others for the work you did on the Mount Angeles School.
Thank you.
It meant a great deal to us. And on the subject of the state continuance of that school, I'm happy to say that there aren't many people making an effort both in the region and the university system to see what the secondary programs might be maintained along with the inclusion of the facility within the system. The question, however, is on the subject of fishing. As you, I'm sure, are aware, there's been quite a lot of in-state comment regarding the bilateral treaty with Canadians on salmon allocation. I think it's not irresponsible to say that you may very probably see a state position in opposition to the treaty should that occur, and I must say that that does take consideration of the comments of the senator last week regarding the idea that the treaty should not be just scrapped, but in fact that negotiations should proceed with hopefully a more equitable arrangement developed. I was wondering if you'd care to comment on that, sir.
Well, thank you. I would share your dissatisfaction with portions of the treaty, particularly as it applies to the Chinook salmon runs, King Salmon and Southeastern, because the inequities are obvious. So the Canadians dropped from, I think, 1,000,001 to 854,000 fish, and we're dropping from 255 by 40,000, so we're probably at about 180,000. That's not proportional. But we've not had any type of an agreement for several decades. The attempt of the treaty was to try and put together some kind of agreement so we could continue to agree and disagree, but at least get something done and set up some talks. Unfortunately, the Canadian attitude towards fisheries seemed to be their first concern was to ensure that their fishermen were out fishing, and ours traditionally has been for the maintenance of the species by controlling the take. I think that I would like to see with, and my attitude is pretty much the direction that the legislature sets to the congressional delegation and of course, the administration. I would like to see made to try and keep the framework, at least the outside parameters of the treaty, to see if we can go in and negotiate the specific points that we are dissatisfied with, and that is the main one. The other idea of throwing the whole thing out doesn't solve the problem. It means that probably our fishermen are not going to be any better off. They may be temporarily, but we still haven't got an agreement, and the agreement is so complex because right now you have Washington that's generally in agreement because they're really not being hurt too bad, but the Washington fishermen
theoretically are taking Canadian Fraser River fish in a disproportionate share, so the Canadians are looking to us for relief, and that's wrong. And I think we're going to have to make a decision very shortly whether we can renegotiate a more equitable arrangement on the troll caught salmon, the Chinooks. And if we can't, then I think we got to stand up and be counted. And if we have to scrap it, we'll have to scrap it.
President Pessinger, are you worth it?
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator, I've always respected your background in banking, and I consider the $1 trillion deficit one of the most serious problems in our national economy. It seems like that places government in competition with private enterprise to borrow money from the bankers. And while we may have low interest today at 10.5 or whatever the rate is still going to go up over the years, and it's going to fluctuate a lot as long as we carry that $1 trillion debt and as long as the government is in competition to borrow this money. Because I would think the bankers will be good businessmen. You mentioned ideas on reducing that debt. Is there any merit to the idea of marketing certain non-pristine public lands to states and residents? Or what are your ideas besides taxation to reduce this significant national debt?
Well, one area that has been explored that has merit is something that you've touched on, and that's to get rid of excess federal property. Now, Secretary Watt came out with some statements, and it was assumed by many people that he was going to sell the national park. Well, he has assured me that that is not his intent, and not just me, the entire committees. He's assured me that there is not going to be any drilling of any kind in our nation's national parks. But there is an awful lot of federal surplus property. You go to any of your major cities and you see port areas that are owned by the federal government that are not used, that are not on the tax rolls. There is an effort underway. Senator Percy is attempting to get the federal government to do an inventory, find out what they have. And then, of course, they don't know that because government has a way of wanting to get bigger, and you don't get bigger by selling out. I think that's the first thing we could do. It's estimated that there is nearly $1.25 trillion worth of excess federal property, and that doesn't include public lands or public interest land. I think it'd be an excellent place to start.
One more question. The Senator does have a new name. Mr. Floor, sir.
Yes, I would. I liked your positive approach to the Alaska fishermen being able to participate in our ground fishery. Had you thought of, and do you have any ideas in increasing the participation of Alaskans into the observer program?
Well, yes, we've made an initial effort, and it's been funded a good deal by industry, I believe, and we're having some problems, I understand, finding people who want to go out there on those foreign boats and bounce around, which I can certainly appreciate, but we've got to do more of it, because without it, why, we're going to have exceptions taken to other species. The incidental catch of halibut or various other things always occur when we don't have observers aboard there, and we are working as a delegation with the various agencies, National Marine Fisheries and others, to try and encourage more funding, and the industry's been most helpful, and I think we can do a better job on it.
The House and the Senate appreciate your being here in joint session. Senator Murkowski, the Speaker, and I do. We thank you for coming.
I'm very honored. Thank you.
Please come back to order. We will have a skeleton session for adjournment purposes in the Senate upon adjournment of the joint session. Senator Ray, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. President. If there's no other business come before the joint session, I move that we stand adjourned.
Great, Chair. House, please stand at ease. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, sir. Have a good day.